This is Mary Lewis at A Tiny Homestead, the podcast comprised entirely of conversations with homesteaders, cottage food producers, and crafters. Today I'm talking with Jeff Poppin about his family legacy of homesteading and his take on organic versus inorganic food. Good morning, Jeff. How are you today?
Everything's good here.
Good. Tell me about yourself and the Barefoot Farmer, because I am dying to know what you do.
Yeah. Okay. Let me push this button right here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a picture of me?
Nope, and I don't have to. It's just audio.
Oh, okay. So this is like a phone call.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay, well then I can set this down here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can still hear me okay?
Yep.
I'm just a worthless hippie, I guess. I don't know. What else you need to know?
I don't think you're a worthless hippie. It sounds like you've done an awful lot of good in looking at your website and your YouTube videos and things. So, go ahead.
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm during the 60s. It was near Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was not just a farmer. He was a retired professor. And he had gotten his doctorates down here in Nashville, Tennessee, and always spoke highly of his time in Tennessee. And my brother and cousin came back from California in the late 60s with the idea of starting a commune on our farm, which, you know, kind of in the air at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And so after a few years, it became apparent that we should get our own place. And so they came down and bought a farm in Tennessee in 1972, and I moved here soon thereafter with my childhood sweetheart, and we lived a very simple lifestyle, you could call it homesteading, with no electricity, no running water, trying to grow our own food, and just trying to live real simply and more or less trying to drop out of the system that we felt was unfair with the racism and wars and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I was 3 in 1972, so I have no working memory of any of it.
Well, you probably heard about the 60s.
Oh, absolutely. And my parents lived through them, and they were kind of away from things. My dad was in the service. And when I was born, I think he had just gotten out of the service. He was in the, I can't remember, Air Force, I think, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And he did not have to go to Vietnam, which was a blessing.
Yeah.
And so they were very to themselves. I mean, they had friends, but they were very to themselves, and they lived in New Jersey when I was born. And then 6 months later, they moved to Maine, and that's where they still are. And they're still together and still very happy.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, they have 14 acres up in mid-state Maine, and they have a dog and they have a garden every year, and they're homesteaders. And that's who I learned it from. So,
well, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. They're 77 and 80 now.
Wow. And tell me a little bit about your podcast. I get a little idea what your customers or your viewers are interested in.
My podcast is literally just conversations with homesteaders, cottage food producers, and crafters, people who make things, who crochet or make tractors out of old treadle sewing machines. I found out that's a thing. Little tractor toys out of treadle machines. Treadle sewing machines. I just want to know what people are doing out there in the world with their hands. And homesteaders use their hands for a lot, and my hands are dirty a lot of the time because we have a homestead too. So you live in Tennessee and you have acreage and you're still doing gardening and homesteading, but you're also doing regenerative farming. That's what I understand.
Well, there's a lot of words for what we do. Back in the day, we called it organic.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was just we wanted to learn how to grow food without using all those chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, my father's garden was organic. And so I learned from him and then, you know, read a lot and made a lot of mistakes and gradually learned roughly how to manage or mismanage a farm. It's right now we have about 270 acres. Most of it is old growth forest or forest that I've let grow up on some of the pasture land.
Uh-huh.
We have about 100 acres open, and that's enough to run about 35, 40 head of cattle that then supply us with enough manure to make compost to fertilize 5 or 6 acres of vegetable crops.
Mm-hmm.
We started a CSA back in the 80s, about the time I started making biodynamic preparations. And we just retired the CSA last year, and now I am wholesaling crops to other CSAs.
Oh, awesome. I didn't even think that was something that was done. I need to tell my husband about that. Okay.
Yeah, so I'm a deep believer in the CSA philosophy that farmers should be supported by their community and their community should be fed by farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And a little closer relationship between those two entities. And ways to foster that intrigue me, not only for the food, but I think that as a homesteader, there's a bit of loneliness involved. And being an urban dweller, there's a little bit of lack of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two things can also be rectified in a model that lets city people, you know, learn about a farm and become part of a farm and benefits the farmer not only in having a guaranteed place to sell the crop or to, you know, support the farm, but also, you know, just some more people that he can care about and you know, interact with.
Yeah. Absolutely. My episode that's being released tomorrow morning is with a lady named Sadie Willis, who is part of the CSA network in the Midwest here. And she told me all about how it's all related and how it's all a big spider web of the farmer, the buyer, the benefits, how they help people get subscriptions to CSAs. It was a really great interview with her, and that's coming out tomorrow morning. So yeah, I am all in on community supported agriculture. I think it's the best thing we can do.
Yeah. But now at my, I'm at retirement age. Mm-hmm. And, it just made sense for me to not do all that hustle and bustle that's required.
Mm-hmm.
With growing, you know, 80 different kinds of vegetables and making sure the van was full of something every week. And
yeah,
over the years, I've developed this, you know, network of other CSAs and people that you know, they're doing all this other stuff, but maybe they don't want to grow potatoes. And then I supply them with potatoes.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's really works out well. Makes my life a little simpler. I still grow all that other stuff for my friends and neighbors and family and all that, you know. but I just don't feel the pressure to have, you know, washed lettuce every week or carrots or whatever.
Yeah, it's a lot of organization and list making and making sure everything is great for the customer. We did a CSA the last 3 years, and my husband is the one who gardens, and he's the one that would get everything ready and set into the bins and ready to be picked up. And he loved it, but it's a lot. It's a lot of stuff to get done. It's a lot of things to keep track of.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of where that's gone. So, one of the things that really I learned from the CSA model is that there's different kinds of work involved in getting food to the table. One of the jobs is plowing, composting, cover cropping, tilling, hoeing, and harvesting. And all those jobs work with the forces of nature and are end up producing things, makes more things than when you started. Mm-hmm. That's the magic of life. The other jobs involved are transporting the stuff and dividing it up and getting, you know, advertising to get customers and maybe cleaning the vegetables a little bit and packaging and all that distribution stuff. These are processes of reduction. We use up the stuff that the farmer produced, and these are processes that are done by humans, not by nature. Mm-hmm. And we need to clarify these two roles. The farmer really doesn't have any business in the marketplace. Farmers are terrible marketers anyway.
And, yes.
And they just need to keep their hands out of the marketplace and let the market do whatever it needs to do with the stuff they produce. And the marketers and the people need to keep their fingers out of what goes on the farm and shouldn't have anything to say about it. And, you know, the farmer knows what to do on the land, and that's his business. And I think having a clear delineation between these two roles clarifies a lot of the confusion that's wrapped around food right now.
Yeah, I agree. My husband's the farmer, I'm the marketer, and never the two shall meet sometimes, I swear.
Yeah. I like to say that a farmer's market is an oxymoron.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, let's not slam the farmers markets, because we sell at farmers markets and we appreciate the outlet and we appreciate the people who buy from us. But yes, farmers market is an oxymoron. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. It's better for me as a farmer that someone else drove the vegetables to Nashville and did all that part of it. And as soon as the van left, I turned around and I was back on my farm doing what I needed to do. Mm-hmm. I couldn't afford to leave once a week and deal with human beings. I'm a pain in the butt.
Sometimes they are. So you have a book coming out in April, and for the life of me, I don't remember the title of it, and I did not write it down. So do you want to tell me about your book that's coming out?
Yeah, so I'm a writer, and Chelsea Green found some of my writings and asked me to write a book. And so it's called Barefoot Biodynamics. And it's kind of some stories about how I fell into the biodynamic method. And it also has a rewritten version of Steiner's agricultural course that was the foundation for the biodynamic method, but is actually a set of lectures that are rather difficult to understand.
Okay.
And I felt like they needed rewriting in more everyday language.
Nice. That will help a lot of people. So I have two questions. One is about organic farming and one is about biodynamic, whatever you just said. Define biodynamic, whatever you just said.
Biodynamic agriculture stems from 8 lectures that Rudolf Steiner gave in 1924 in response to the recent development of artificial fertilizers, in particular the synthesis of nitrogen and the ability to use ammonium nitrate as a replacement for manures and legume cover crops on farms.
Okay, thank you, because I was going to look it up last night and I totally forgot to look it up, because that's what happens when you're making dinner and your husband gets home from work and the dog is barking and the kid who still lives here says, "Hey, Mom." So yeah, I completely forgot to look it up and now I feel dumb. And then organic farming. I have a little minor hang up with the word organic, and I'm going to run this by you and then you can either tell me whether I'm wrong or right. I understand that organic food is food that has not been grown using man-made pesticides or herbicides. And you have to be certified to claim that your produce is organic. However, here's why I get hung up. We don't use man-made herbicides or insecticides in our garden, but we also cannot afford to get certified as organic, as an organic farm. It's a lot of money. And my thing is, I feel like, yes, you can control what you're putting in the dirt and on the plants and do the best you can to be organic. But I also feel like there's such a thing as drift in the air from other people's properties, and you can't control that. So my question to you is, anything actually factually organically grown? Because I need to know.
Well, that's a big question.
It is.
In chemistry, the organic chemistry is the chemistry of fossil fuels and chemicals.
Okay.
That's interesting. In the 20s, through Rudolf Steiner's lectures, some people started farming, consciously trying not to use any of the chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the next decade, Sir Albert Howard in India, F.H. King in China, Rodale in the United States, started promoting the idea of organic agriculture. And this then kind of blossomed later, 20 years later in the 70s. Became a little bit more known. But, even as far back as the 1800s, you have George Washington Carver talking about organic wastes and the importance of that, to be returned to the soil. And many of the USDA books from the pre-1900 era have excellent information on how to farm, using just what's on the farm already. You've got your cattle and your legume cover crops and your rotations and mm-hmm. and things of this nature. And so it was actually the way people farmed. And so my study has been how people farmed back in the late 1800s,
sure,
after they had discovered a whole lot of things, but not the chemicals yet. And so I feel like they had a pretty good handle on what it took to make crops. So then you have about the time I got into it in the 70s, there was probably maybe 4,000 or so organic farmers in the U.S. And the USDA at that time was saying that organics was really a bad idea and wouldn't feed the world, and that they should just quit talking about that, and everybody should use chemicals, get bigger, get out. All the things that you would find in Wendell Berry's writings, such as The Unsettling of America.
Okay.
And that's been documented pretty well. So these handful of organic farmers then researched and figured out how to grow stuff organically. They also developed all of the markets for organic foods. And they threw events, little conferences and stuff, where they could get together and, you know, share resources and talk about it and that kind of thing. And so that's kind of what I grew up in with in the 80s and stuff, was learning about from those types of people and being one of them, you know, trying to figure out how to do this. In 1990, the U.S. Congress passed the Organic Protection Act, which basically stated that the USDA recognized that there was such a thing as organic farming. It wasn't going to go away. So they figured they had to get their hands in it, and they did. So over the course of the next 12 years, there was a lot of arguing about it. Now, these organic farmers, such as myself, were sort of excited that, you know, the USDA was turning around and finally recognizing us.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time the standards came out in 2002, that was when it became illegal to say that your food was organic unless you had a certification. That it was so watered down that it lost a lot of its meaning. So consequently, someone like me, I'd been certified organic and biodynamic for 15 years.
Yeah.
But I chose to drop certification in 2002. It started becoming expensive, and a lot of the rules I didn't even believe in, you know, I didn't think they were correct. And so at that point, you know, it became illegal for me to call my food organic.
Yes.
So I just called it organic. I just dropped the R. And that worked fine for me.
Okay.
And so can food be organic? Well, you know, the world is what it is. And, yeah, there's cesium-30 and strontium-90 everywhere at this point, and many things of that nature. They're making more DDT now than they ever did. You know, they just can't spray it in the United States, but they spray it all over the world, you know.
Right.
And so it just seems like we need to just use common sense and just do the best we can. And, you know, you may not use chemicals in your garden, but there's chemicals in your life. It's hard not to, it's hard to get away from them totally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to not let the perfect get in the way of just doing what's good and right and moral. And for me, putting chemicals on the soil is immoral. It's just not right thing to do. And it doesn't matter to me the prices are more or less or anything like that. I just have to farm the way that my land tells me to do and listen to it. Mm-hmm. And not to the marketplace to make my decisions. My decisions should come from what's best for the farm.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. We were asked a couple of times 2 summers ago if we were organic certified. And my husband said, no, but we do everything we can to practice the things that would make us able to be certified. We do the best we can.
You can also just say you're uncertified organic.
Yeah, true.
And what I always did was, if I said that, I would say, and you're more than welcome to come to the farm and poke around my barn and look around and see what, you know, see how I do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that transparency is more important than labels.
Yeah. Yep. I think you're right. Well, I was just curious, and since you know a lot more about all of this than I do, I wanted to ask because I knew you would have a good answer.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't really have a whole lot more questions for you, Jeff. I usually keep these at 25, 30 minutes, and we've been talking for 25, so we're good. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, and I will, when I write the description for this episode, I will put your website in there and the fact that you have a book coming out in April, because I'm sure that there are people who want to read it.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me on your show, Mary.
Yeah, thank you. I know you're busy, so thank you for your time.
No problem. I've got all the time in the world. I'm a farmer.
All right, have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.